We recently hit yet another huge milestone here at the CyberWork Podcast, 25,000 YouTube subscribers. Thanks to all of you who watch and listen each week, to those of you who watch the YouTube videos go live and chat with each other in comments, and everyone who is helping us to grow this great community. To give back, we're now giving you 30 days of team training for teams of 10 or more. Your InfoSec skills account will help your entire team develop their skills and earn CPEs through hundreds of IT and security courses, cloud-hosted cyber ranges, hands-on projects, skills assessments, and certification practice exams. Plus, you can easily monitor, assign, and track training progress with team admin and reporting features. If you have 10 or more people who need skills training, head over to infosecinstitute.com/cyberwork or click the link in the description to take advantage of this special offer for CyberWork listeners. And thank you once again for listening to and watching our podcast. We appreciate each and every one of you coming back each week. And on that note, I've got someone I'd like you to meet. So let's begin the episode. Welcome to this week's episode of the CyberWork with InfoSec podcast. Each week, I sit down with a different industry thought leader, and we discuss the latest cybersecurity trends, how those trends are affecting the work of InfoSec professionals, while offering tips for those trying to break in or move up the ladder in the cybersecurity industry. Today's guest is Amin Gilani, and he comes to us from 4IQ, an attribution intelligence company who are, quote, on a mission to unmask cybercriminals. According to their statement of purpose, they track the use of stolen personal identities by scouring the hidden corners of the internet. Before this, Amin was a red teamer with Booz Allen Hamilton, and we'll talk a little bit about red team operations as well as his time emulating sophisticated attacks against securities trading platforms and payment systems. Amin Gilani is the Vice President of Product at 4IQ, a Los Altos-based adversary intelligence company. Previously, he was Chief Technologist at Booz Allen Hamilton, where he provided expertise to federal and commercial clients focusing on incident response, red teaming, threat hunting, and cybersecurity operations engineering. Prior to joining Booz Allen, Amin was a Vice President in Information Security at Goldman Sachs, where he led red team operations and emulated sophisticated attacks against security trading platforms and payment systems. He began his career serving in the United States Air Force as an intelligence agent and was on detail at National Security Agency and the United States Cyber Command. Amin, thank you for joining us today on CyberWork.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So we like to start each show, and our listeners know the drill by this point, but hearing about the sort of roots of your interest in computers and security, was this an early interest of yours? Did you get interested in it later in life? Did it come when you were, with military?
Well, I did. I wish I did have a compelling story about my history in computer science early in my days, but I really didn't, wasn't really interested in anything computer related unless it was a video game. Really interested in, Sega and Nintendo, Excitebike, Mortal Kombat,
Excitebike. There's a name from the past. I love it.
Exactly. We did have a computer at home, Windows 95, my uncle one time gave me a book on HTML and how to build websites. And I took a little interest in that, but then, as a young teenager, I just kind of lost interest immediately. So I took it a lot more serious in life once I joined the Air Force and started working at NSA.
Okay. So what aspect of, you get to the Air Force and what is it there? Did they say, we want you to work on security or computer stuff? Or are you sort of looking at the options and you're like, oh, this sounds interesting to me?
Yeah, so I actually joined. I joined the military as an intelligence analyst. Not necessarily focused anything on computer security, but mostly on tracking adversaries.
I see.
So this was around the 2004 timeframe, post 9/11, of course. And my main mission was to track bad guys through their devices or understanding where they are location wise, and it was really more about tracking. And then eventually, after the 2007 surge, once we no longer worked on this kind of operations, my commander told me to look into changing units into this thing called JFCC&W, which is the Joint Functional Component Command of Network Warfare. It has a very small Wikipedia page, but essentially it was the offensive arm of Cyber Command, what Cyber Command is today. And so it was a blessing in disguise. And that's when I really got into computer security and is more on the offensive side. It was the peak of offensive security at that point.
Right. Well, I was going to say that jumps perfectly into the next question, is that clearly you got some degree of excitement about sort of going after the bad guys. So is this sort of where you started to focus on attack focus, pen testing, and red team operations? Is there something about the thrill of the hunt specifically that brought you to this career direction?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So going after, you know, bad guys itself, it was great to use, you know, open source methods at one point, but then as like the attack landscape kind of changed, we had to adopt to it. Right. So whenever you have adversaries, you know, first, you know, using text messages for their operations, now they're using websites, they're using, you know, Al-Qaeda, you know, based magazines like Inspire and stuff like that. So it's up to us to do, to do disruption and destruction at that same time. So it was, we just had to evolve the way Enemy evolved, and that's what we do today as well.
Okay. So yeah, I want to talk more about your red teaming past later on, but for now I want to talk about your work with 4iQ. So tell me about the company's mission. I summarized it briefly in the bio of unmasking cyber criminals, but like, what are your methods and what are the tools you use to accomplish this, and sort of what's the parameter of what you do?
Yeah. So the mission of 4iQ is essentially to disrupt adversaries and to protect identities as well. And we do have two different business lines on that. So identity theft, of course, we have all this great information through breach information, right? So as you guys know, you know, breaches happen all the time. You have MyFitnessPal, right? Constantly. It's constantly a news cycle and people are becoming numb to it. But essentially, we're collecting that data and taking it and, of course, protecting people immediately with it, right? So we're working with people who are focused on the consumer end, and we power a lot of those companies to help protect identities on the consumer end. So anytime a breach happens, we'd like to alert that provider immediately, saying that this account is compromised, these passwords are out there, and they should change it, take quick action on it, right? Mm-hmm. Also at the enterprise level with this data, we're helping prevent account takeover. And so that's the obvious thing, right?
Right.
We later realized that the bad people, the most heinous people in the world, are also in this data. And we created a platform that can find that needle in the haystack and really dive deep on these people. And we're not just collecting credential data for the unmasking part. We're actually grabbing, you know, usernames from, you know, dark market forums, from you know, crypto wallets that are associated with ransomware. There's a lot of cataloging and labeling that we're also doing, and being able to correlate that with breach data, we can find the real people behind it. So we're correlating IP addresses, passwords. We're also correlating usernames, pretty much any attribute that you can find in a breach. We're trying to correlate all the information so people can, you know, they can't hide behind any kind of username or moniker anymore.
Wow. So I guess I want to sort of find out a little bit about like how your team works. I mean, I'm curious about the division of labor. You say you've got people sort of collating all these things. So like, what does a team look like who's like working on one particular criminal, or does everyone have sort of multiple caseloads?
Yeah, actually, we're not cataloging adversaries the way other threat intelligence organizations would. Okay. Our platform is more of an enablement tool that we have, of course, 25 billion records, and, you know, numbers just, it doesn't really mean anything at that scale, but sure. Really what we're doing here is we're just sourcing a lot of these criminal networks, and we're creating a tool where anyone who's working an investigation, whether it be on the fraud or anti-money laundering side, where they want to make sure that they're onboarding like a legitimate person using their credentials, we're validating that, right? And there's a lot to be said about no history as well. So really the division of labor of the company is, a lot of it is going into engineering to develop this very sophisticated platform. And of course, we also have threat intel analysts as well that are collecting this data you know, having presence in these forums in order to obtain that data.
Okay. So how did your company come to the decision to, you know, go into sort of attacking the problem of attribution by chasing down stolen personal identities and so forth? You mentioned some of these organizations, but I don't hear that much about these types of hunters. I mean, most security groups that we talk to, you know, work on the defense and remediation side of things. So I'm curious how you came to sort of settle into this relatively uncommon area of the security space.
It's totally uncommon, right? And I think attribution is...
And it's something that like people are frustrated about. It feels like, you know, you hear that all the time. It's like, why can't we take the fight to them, you know, and stuff like that.
Yeah, you should.
Right. So, you know, it's why it's so exciting to hear about this.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is actually the most exciting thing, right? Like I think, so just a little history, right? So I started off my career in the Air Force in NSA, like hunting bad people, right? Mm-hmm. And it was so much fun. And you know, those authorities really only exist in the intelligence community and the military. But, you know, once I moved on to, you know, to Booz Allen and Goldman Sachs, like the operation of that type, it really doesn't exist. It didn't exist at that point, right? So
right.
Once I saw this platform, actually Julio Casal, our founder and CTO, he showed me this tool and he's like, yeah, you know, we're just kind of, you know, unmasking bad people. And I realized that, hey, you're actually solving the problem of attribution. Like you're actually unmasking cyber criminals. And I was thrilled about it. Right.
Yeah.
And so that drew me to it. And I was brought on to, you know, bring this product to market and see how we can sell it in the US. Right. And we found a critical need for it too, because it's not really about, you know, it's not about, you know, finding the bad person and attacking them. It's really about how does this bad person really impact your network? How do they disrupt your operations? And it ultimately costs a lot of, you know, money towards fraud because of this, right? So, you know, right now we're really trying to help, you know, the know your customer organizations, the anti-money laundering and fraud organizations, as well as those teams that are focused on cybercrime intelligence, right? So how can we really understand the people that are attacking us and how can we disrupt them so we can ultimately, you know, reduce like the loss of fraud within the organization.
So who are your clients? Are you sort of working for sort of legal organizations that are working to, and you're sort of like their research department, or are you working for people like banks or whatever who have been, you know, who have been hacked and want to sort of like, you know, get back? I mean, like,
yeah.
I don't really have a sense of that.
Yeah, so the people who are really interested in this type of work, right now, short answer, of course, would be financial organizations, okay. But as well as law enforcement and intelligence community, only because there's a couple of factors that are really helpful. And, you know, there'd be, you know, the appetite, right? Like who has the appetite to take on this type of mission, right? The authority, you want to make sure that, you know, the organizations that has an attribution program actually is able to, they're legally able to take down bad people or actually arrest them and have some kinds of orders in order to reduce this kind of risk. And of course they have to have the ability as well, right? They have to have the resources and teams. So right now, as I mentioned, you know, law enforcement and government in general is a good client of ours, but as well as financial, because essentially they're charged to really reduce the risk. And if we're continuously playing whack-a-mole of, you know, blocking indicators of compromise, it's a never-ending game, right? Whitelisting, blacklisting certain sites. It's just, we're always just, you know, tackling the problem in a very, very one-dimensional way, where I think that if you were to go after the adversary itself, that would cause the real disruption, right? And you get, it's a much better ROI.
Yeah. So you're kind of facilitating for people who have the actual legal recourse to sort of come in and do the arrests.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So what are some of the challenges in going after cyber criminals in this way? Have you had to worry about like retribution? Are there, you know, is there anything where like, you know, other hackers sort of like try to hack you guys to sort of take revenge or anything like that?
That's a great question. We haven't seen anything at that scale, fortunately.
Okay.
I think that, you know, the retribution part is always going to be a concern, right? There's so many organizations in security that are out there that kind of expose much larger networks, right? If there's a particular nation state actor that used a certain attack against a bank, they'll have not only their TTPs, but also, you know, who was compromised, and they can kind of categorize exactly who this person is. So I think a lot of security organizations are going through this, you know, this issue of potentially being retaliated.
Okay. So, you know, in your interest in sort of getting out of the sort of whack-a-mole move of just, you know, defense and actually going after them, do you have a sense, this is probably unlikely, but do you have a sense of like what the total sort of number of adversaries there are? Like if, as you take out, these are, you know, are you taking them out the way that, you know, like you see like the sort of like Al Qaeda, you know, org charts and things like that? Are there sort of like big guns that you've taken out that have sort of like destabilized, you know, aspects of hacking, or do people just kind of keep scrambling and filling the holes?
It's such an interesting time right now because it's hard to put a number on it, only because the larger cybercrime is almost like a business, right? Like, yeah. I can't remember what the numbers are, but you know,
yeah, it is a business.
Was it $3 to $6 trillion will be lost in 2020,
right?
Because of cybercrime. And so it seems like it is when you look at it as a market perspective, it's obviously a very big business and good business to get into. So I think even if we take down certain actors, there might be an increase in the type of, I think there still be a lot of, you know, people that are getting into the game as well, doing, you know, low level ransomware type act and stuff like that. But I think that I think the problem is that the fact that not many organizations are going after these criminal groups, it makes it a lot easier for that business to continue, right? Mm-hmm. Criminals will keep doing it if there's really no retaliation or any kind of action against law enforcement against them. So as long as there's really no real action, it's going to continue to grow. And that's why we're here. We want to reduce that number of cybercrime. We want to, make sure that, you know, there is some kind of responsibility behind any kind of attacks.
So what exactly are the sort of hidden corners of the internet that you mentioned it briefly, but like where are you looking for these sorts of people? How are you sort of, you know, doing the tracking of IPs and like what, you know, what are the areas of the internet that we don't know about and we don't want to know about that you're in regularly?
Yeah. Well, so let's start with the basic ones that are just right out there, right? You can go to raid forums. You can just Google it right now, raid forums, and you can find like terrible things right away. So sometimes it's right in front of your nose, right? But there's other places where, of course, there are more nefarious things available, not just, you know, credit card dumps. There are there's a bunch of terrible stuff out there, like, you know, like human trafficking related things. There's child pornography. There's a lot of heavy stuff out there that is being sold and traded. And those are the types of people that we want to take down. Right. And so those are, you know, using, you know, I2P and Tor networks. And there's just a lot of different sites that are out there, you know, protected sites, but as well as there are, you know, similar sites like Silk Road and Alphabay that keep popping up. There's always these big marketplaces that sell, you know, weapons to manuals on how to build bombs and just a bunch of stuff. So there, it's endless, right? It's endless. Okay. But I think that a lot of them are also just open source. You can just look it up today, which is unfortunate too.
Okay. So yeah, you know, when I think of like, you know, a hacker, you know, kind of getting in there, you know, they're sort of, you know, disguised, but they're basically using, you know, like the network of the banking company, and they're going in there. Do your employees have to do like a similar disguise to go into some of these kind of Silk Road places? Like, do you ever like find out that, you know, you're in there asking questions and people are like, wait a minute, are you a cop? Are you, you know, coming for us or whatever? Is there anything like that?
Yeah. there's always stuff like that out there. I don't want to reveal too much, but of course we have to protect our employees as well. Right. We don't want them to be in any kind of danger, but I think that, you know, conducting surveillance and understanding what's out there is really helpful to know as well on how our clients as well as us, how we should be prepared and how we should be protecting our families as well.
Right. So I want to, you know, pivot this a little bit. The name of the podcast course is Cyber Work, and we want to talk about sort of careers and, you know, how you can get into these things. So did your background in penetration testing and red teaming prepare you for this type of work? I mean, it sounds like you were kind of doing them, you know, on parallel tracks, but are there ways in which the two processes are similar and ways that they're different, like the sort of like intelligence work that you do versus like red teaming?
Yeah, I think in this case, I think that having an intelligence background, because essentially 4IQ is an intelligence company, right? And having an intelligence background, but also understanding adversaries, it just happened to be a perfect mix. I mean, this is my dream job, right? Hunting bad people, you know, in a public place with the authority, I think it's pretty awesome, right? And they do their job. And I think that's the real mission that we're behind, right? So I honestly think I just got lucky. And I wish I could give a recipe for that. But I would say that, you know, for those who are listening and that are interested in, let's say, red teaming, Specifically, there's so many things that you could learn that is just completely available. I learned some of the best tricks. I learned how to use like Kali Linux mostly on YouTube before I took my first SANS class or OSCP, right? So I think there's just a lot of free resources available, even if you wanted to learn about how intelligence, how intelligence analysis processes are done, the intelligence lifecycle. There's so many great things that are out there in order to really sharpen your skills.
Yeah. So if someone wanted to get into the type of work that 4IQ does specifically and chase down cyber criminals and hackers and, you know, do cyber attribution, so what are some specific skills, experiences, or certs that you would want to see on their resume? What type of candidates stick out, you know, in the resume pile for this sort of thing?
Specifically on resumes?
I would just you're sort of getting a sense of the person. Like, what are things you want to hear them say? Oh, I've done this, or I've tried this, I've learned that.
Yeah, I'd say you have to do your research, right? You have to be naturally curious, because if you want to, if you really want to understand threat actors, you have to understand their motive. You have to understand their perspective and how, and take a walk in their shoes too, right? So I think that anyone who's worked in any kind of investigations and who's just naturally curious, they've been really good analysts from what I know. Even when I worked at Goldman, I had a really good colleague. Her name is Sarah, and she worked at PETA as an investigator.
Oh, wow.
And now she is the global head of intelligence at a really big bank now. Wow. And I think that having that background and having a drive to learn more, I think that's the most, that's probably the best thing you can do. And you know, having that translate in the resumes would be, I think, making sure that anytime you put anything down, make sure that you use those words and those actions that show what the impact really was when you did some kind of investigation or you did any kind of analysis, right? Because, you know, from a resume base, it's all about outcomes, right?
Right.
Like, how do you make it an impact? But along the side about getting into a job, something like this, I'd say that, you know, I mentioned, you know, how we evolve to enemy tactics. I think, you know, people who are seeking jobs in this industry also have to evolve. And I think that, you know, a lot of jobs are won by personalities and getting to know each other, right? Being just a resume in a stack is, I don't think it's good enough anymore at times. I think you have to utilize, you know, you have to slide into DMs, right? You have to reach out to people via LinkedIn or wherever their avenue is and really try to connect with them, right? Not sound salesy, not sound like you're trying to sell something, but, you know, really show that you are looking for an opportunity and you have, you know, the world to prove to them.
Yeah, you're looking for a life's mission rather than a next job.
Exactly. Yeah.
We had another person who's an expert in red teaming last week, and I don't know if this applies here, but with the recent shelter in place orders due to COVID-19, you know, happening worldwide, I'm assuming that attack services have, you know, shifted a bit, but obviously hackers and bad actors, if anything, stepped their game up. Have you seen any difference in the, you know, in amidst the current pandemic with the way your company has to do its work? Do you find that hackers are behaving differently at all in April of 2020 than they were a few months ago?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Right. I think even the hackers probably have extra time now being at home.
Right.
Yeah. Right? So, so I think that in this case, we're seeing a lot of two things. So I would say a lot of it has to do with account takeover and business email compromise. There's just an increase, right? People are using breach data to hack into accounts now, right? And it's more prevalent now than ever. The second thing, what I was gonna mention, is disinformation campaigns. We're seeing so many different news stories, whether it be on Twitter or Facebook, but just false information that's even given by officials in the US because they're misinformed. Right. And I think that's probably the most dangerous thing. And you know, as we talk about evolution of threat trends, surprisingly, this threat trend is not malware, right? It's not something that's so sneaky. It's something that's
the human element,
It's something that's very obvious. And so this is like the disinformation campaigns that we're seeing are, you know, who started, COVID? Is it because of 5G related things, which just sounds ridiculous, right? It's kind of like the anti-vax movement, but on like a 20-30x scale, even probably bigger, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, do you guys have any ability to sort of impact disinformation campaigns? That feels to me like a different battle from going after specific actors.
Yeah. So one of the things I didn't mention is that we also have another platform that has that does a lot of sentiment analysis for social media as well as web, as well as just like the general surface web. And so we're able to detect a lot of different, sentiments that are being pushed out from accounts. And we can actually map out where certain messages are being pushed by geolocation, but as well as the types of people. We can categorize a lot of users as well. So we can really boil the ocean of where these kinds of campaigns are moving from. And of course, with our attribution capability, we're able to even detect, let's say, for example, election campaigns and seeing who is spreading false information and what accounts belong in that nefarious or malicious infrastructure, right? So we can kind of pinpoint which countries or companies are actually pushing this kind of information, for confusion or for chaos.
So where would, if, you know, people are suspecting that, you know, some of these stories are, smelling a bit funny or whatever, like what would, do you sort of report your findings in terms of like figuring out where these disinformation campaigns are coming from? And if so, where would people look for this kind of information?
Yeah, actually, we do post some of the stuff on our website when we find these things. But I think the best thing to do is to kind of ask yourself all the time, is this real or not, right? I mean, I'm not sure if you're in family WhatsApp chats or not, but my mom will always send me things like, things that are clearly fake, right? And they'll say, this is the new type of attack, and it's just a scare tactic or a scary news story that just happens. My mom listens to this, she'll probably be really mad at me that I called her out. But it's true, right? A lot of people do get confused by the information that's there because they don't know how to trust it, right? So I think everyone should just be a good citizen and just kind of, take it at face value and kind of dive in deeper, have that curiosity built in as an intelligence analyst or, just as a curious person to make sure that that these do sound real. And, of course, check a bunch of different news sources just to make sure.
Yeah. Do your due diligence. It's not enough to just find the thing that sounds good. So I want to sort of ask you from a general security perspective, and especially as someone who's a former red team leader, or maybe still do some of that, but are there any suggestions you might have for the currently scattered organizations, out there, everyone sort of working from home, working in, offsite or in unusual places to make sure that their, temporarily displaced staff or IT department aren't inadvertently creating huge security crises?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing that we see, like the obvious thing is something like Zoom, right? Like how do they have, open rooms available just to join, right? Open links for invitations. So it's kind of scary, right? But of course there's a lot of these measures. You can just Google, top five things to, protect your Zoom accounts and stuff like that. But, for scattered, security professionals at this moment, I'd say there's like probably three big things to really focus on. And this is the same approach that I took at Goldman Sachs when you led the red team there. But there's three. So the first thing would be like thought experiments, right? So as there's a mobile workforce and everything is different now, I think that understanding what your applications are and kind of thinking about it, like how can an attacker or anyone else that's unauthorized get into this, right? So just play out different scenarios in your head, right? And I think that's really easy to do. And, I think as security professionals as being like naturally paranoid, people always think about this, right? But they don't, a lot of times they don't write it down or, escalate it more saying, hey, we should consider these types of threats, right? So doing some like general thought experiments, whether you're, planting something in your garden or taking a shower, always be thinking about that kind of stuff, because if you realize it, that means it must be real, right? And the second thing is like wargaming it out, right? So not only wargaming certain threats, but also approaching it the way an adversary would. Like if I were to play every step of this out, like what are those things that we should be considering and what controls can we put in today in order to potentially prevent an incident like that, right? So it evolves from, of course, like a thought experiment to wargaming and then to actually doing a pen test on it, see if after you put your controls, if there's something that's actually exploitable or not. So I think just playing those wargames are always helpful to mature your security.
Perfect. So as we wrap up today, what are some technologies or tactics that might be coming soon to the world of cyber attribution intelligence? What are some things that, you can see new tools available to you that you're looking forward to in 2020, 21 and beyond?
Yeah. I would say, so like I mentioned, like disinformation is a huge thing, right?
Yeah.
I think that disinformation is going to continue to grow, and that's going to continue to be a large threat. But from the attribution perspective in general, I think that we're seeing that a lot of organizations from financial and law enforcement are actually adopting some type of attribution program. And I think that's awesome because, you know, working with financial organizations and the government, but as well as commercial, I know that, you know, security teams and fraud and anti-money laundering teams are usually siloed. They usually never talk to each other, right? But we're noticing that a lot of crime is cyber enabled. And so we're seeing this huge shift from, you know, leading and innovative banks fuse these two teams together, which I love, right? Like, it's great to have collaboration. It's great to understand that, there's a lot of cyber enabled malware, and that malware is directly impacting fraud, right? So it's obvious that they should be talking to each other. And I think that's probably the biggest trend that we're going to see is the financial organizations are going to continue to mature in that space and hopefully reduce the amount of cybercrime.
Okay. If you could, I want to sort of end on sort of a philosophical note here, but like, if you could kind of wave a magic wand and sort of make all this work out, like what are the sort of blockades right now? Would you want to see more sort of cyber attribution? Do you want to see sort of more people taking the fight? What would be like an optimal version where there's sort of enough, you know, counter attackers to take out the attackers and things like that? What does that landscape look like to you?
Well, yeah. if I could just wave a magic wand, I'd probably get rid of all the cyber criminals. But
job with it.
Yeah, I think authority, right? I think that in general, whether it be espionage related cyber attacks, or it might be cyber crime related, I think that private organizations are sitting ducks, right? There's no the government has not given any kind of authority or ability for organizations to hack back or even retrieve their data back, right? It's just not a concept that's real just yet, right? So I think that, and obviously the government's not going to do too much about it. They already have their hands tied trying to protect their own government networks, right? So how is it even possible that they would support any kind of private organization and you show favoritism and, you know, it's just not clear, right? So if banks or private organizations in general just had authority to take control, I think that would probably be the best way to do it. Of course, there's a lot of downside to it. How do you verify you've been hacked by this person or this organization? Right. There's a lot of things, but I think that having that authority would really help. It's like the old Marx and the letter of mark and reprisal. Just like the way ships used to be, taken down by pirates, right? When things get stolen by pirates, there's the letter of marks and reprisal where, ships or captains of these ships had authority to, get their stuff back and defend themselves. And I think that's the type of policy that we should have for organizations, because there is a constant exfiltration of intellectual property that's happening here, that, what makes America great is actually, it's being diluted by counterfeits and stolen information that we make.
So one last question today. If listeners want to know more about Amin Gilani or 4IQ, where can they go online?
Well, LinkedIn, Real Amin G. The Real Amin G is my LinkedIn / Real Amin G. And then 4IQ, we're always doing stuff. So please keep an eye out for us. And, one of the biggest things that we put out recently is that we're offering our identity theft services out to all healthcare providers and hospitals. So you guys can go to our website and check that out and have some free help for a few months during the crisis.
And 4IG is just numeral 4, letter I, letter G.com?
4IQ, yeah.
4IQ, sorry, of course. 4I, numeral 4, letter I, letter Q.com.
Absolutely. Right?
Okay. Amin, thank you again for being here today. This was fascinating. We could go on and on, but I will let you go today. So thank you again.
Thank you so much.
And thank you all for listening and watching today. If you enjoyed today's video, you can find many more on our YouTube page. Just go to youtube.com and type in CyberWork with InfoSec to check out our collection of tutorials, interviews, and past webinars. If you'd rather have us in your ears during your workday, all of our videos are also available as audio podcasts. Just search CyberWork with InfoSec in your podcast catcher of choice. And if you wouldn't mind, leave a rating and review on your podcast catcher of choice. It really does help us out. So for a free month of our InfoSec skills platform that we discussed in the top of today's show, just go to InfoSecInstitute.com/skills and sign up for an account. And in the coupon code, type in the word cyberwork, all one word, all small letters, no spaces, and get your free month. Thank you once again to Amin Gilani, and thank you all again for watching and listening. We will speak to you next week. Stay safe.